Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Mark Silcox. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Humanities and Philosophy at the University of Central Oklahoma. He is the co-author with John Cogburn of Philosophy Through Video Games, and their co-edited open court volume, Dungeons and Dragons and Philosophy, Raiding the Temple of Wisdom, came out in late 2012. He is mainly interested in meta-ethics, aesthetics, the philosophy of language, and the philosophy of games. And today we're going to focus mostly on the philosophy of games and some aspects of ethics related to that. And we're going to talk about things like the experience machine and others related to the philosophy of games. So, Dr. Silcox, thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, great. So I would like to start the conversation by talking a little bit about that thought experiment that famously Robert Nozick came up with, that he called the experience machine, right? I mean, I think there are somewhat different versions of it, but could you give us the gist of the thought experiment? And perhaps the main issues that Nozick wanted to explore with it.
Sure. So it's a very famous and a very succinct argument in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and it shows up in a rather odd context where Nozick's really doing this very 1970s American thing of free associating. He talks a little bit about animals and a little bit about human rights, and in the middle is this argument, usually taken to be a fairly straight argument against any form of philosophical hedonism. So the stakes are fairly high in the argument, but it's a thought experiment, as you mentioned, and the thought experiment is a little science fiction-y. The idea is that what Nozick calls super-duper neuropsychologists have invented a machine that has some sort of direct interface into your brain and that can give you any experiences that you could possibly want. And the implication of the way he described it is it's free, it's potentially available to everyone. So that everybody, or at least every adult, is faced with a choice about whether to plug into this. The one stipulation is you have to plug into it for the rest of your life. There's no way to do it temporarily, which of course all of us would do because it sounds pretty fun. But you have to; it has to be a permanent addition to your life. You can occasionally unplug from it to change your preferences or your so-called menu of experiences. But you have to be in it ultimately until you die, with only these occasional breaks to change the program. So Nozick asks his audience or his readership what they think they would do, and he thinks it's just obvious the overwhelming majority of them would not plug in. And Nozick takes this to be at least a very powerful intuitive argument against hedonism, since he thinks the hedonist would have absolutely no reason whatsoever not to plug in, whereas we all, or most of us, feel that there obviously would be reasons to stay away from the thing.
But I mean, there are different versions of hedonism, right? What did he mean by hedonism in that case? Is it that he was suggesting in the thought experiment that the experience machine would be about people only experiencing pleasure, or is it something different than that?
Part of what's interesting about the argument for me is that he doesn't really have much to say to predict about how people would program the machine if, say, they were compelled to plug in or if they were fantasizing about plugging in. I don't think he says that we would necessarily all want an unbroken stream of pleasure, as that word is usually thought of. But the way he characterizes hedonism, which I think is correct and usefully abstract, is any view that thinks that there's nothing important or valuable about our experiences apart from how they feel to us. So I suppose you could have that kind of view and not be a hedonist if you were a bizarrely philosophical masochist, as long as you thought that the value of any experience is exhausted by how it feels to the experiencer. That's what Nozick thinks is wrong, and what he thinks the experience machine is able to show is wrong.
And some of the most important questions that are put on the table here have to do with what people value in life, what is considered the real life experience, and what people want from their lives or in their lives, what they want to happen and how they want to experience things, right?
Yeah. What fascinates me about this argument and has led me to be somewhat obsessed with it over the past few years, and I've put together a book of papers, and I always teach it in my classes, isn't so much whether Nozick's right or wrong, which is difficult to determine, although that's, of course, what you're ultimately interested in. But it's this idea that we have intuitions about the value of experiences based on knowing nothing about them whatsoever, except that they're simulated. That they involve interacting with an unreal world or a virtual world. And I'm not a metaphysician particularly, so I don't have a huge beef on what counts as a real life experience. But I think Nozick's right to suppose that most people have fairly strong views about the value of an experience on the basis just of what it's a simulation of, or just to the extent to which it's a simulation. Setting apart how it might feel, or how it might fit into the broader fabric of their lives. But I don't think we have any really good theories about what to make of those intuitions or how to render them consistent. So that, for me, is the value of the thought experiment. This idea that if, in some sense, an experience isn't of reality, we maybe devalue it. Or at least think it has some sort of special status when we deliberate about how to live.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I find particularly interesting when we are questioned, for example, by Robert Nozick to think about these kinds of things is that, for example, recently I've had on the show Donald Hoffman that has released the book called The Case Against Reality. And basically the gist of the thing is that we haven't evolved to experience reality as it is, but only a version, let's say, of reality that is useful for us as organisms to survive, to reproduce, and to basically have evolutionary success. So, I mean, if you put things in those terms, it gets a little bit more complicated to think about to what extent a simulated reality would be that different if it was good enough and convincing enough from what we already experience in our everyday lives, let's say. I don't know if you ever thought about that or not. But.
Yeah. Hoffman's obviously right, although in a way that students often rebel against, to suppose that if we do have some sort of epistemic grip on reality, it's more likely to be a side effect or a byproduct of our evolution than the point of it all. I mean, when there's no evolutionary drive to see things as they truly are rather than as is helpful. The problem with pushing that intuition too far in epistemology is it quickly generates paradox, right? If we can't experience reality at all, then the word reality in our vocabulary must mean something different, right? So as an epistemic question, I think one very quickly gets tangled up worrying about that. If our brains are big simulators and our brains are all we have, then the concept of simulation becomes pretty trivial pretty quickly. But axiologically, I think if you take his insights seriously, you find yourself thinking, well, maybe there's something good about an experience to the extent that it's simulated. If we can talk about degrees of simulation, or if we can come up with some contrast class that separates simulated experiences from non-simulated experiences, maybe simulation itself has a kind of value. Not necessarily an absolute value. I'm not, you know, philosophers don't think that it's always bad to know the truth, but something that can be captured by reflecting a little on one's intuitions about something like the experience machine.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we are talking about two different things here, right? On the one hand, we are talking about what could happen if people were literally put in a simulated reality. But on the other hand, we are also invited to think about, to us ourselves create a simulated version of reality where we can experiment with, for example, different types of arguments and different types of realities to really know if we should apply those sorts of things in our real reality, let's say.
Yes, yeah, I think so. One of the, amongst the philosophers who like to argue about this and hang around in places, you know, like Copenhagen and Poland, talking about virtual reality at this level of abstraction, is I think it really matters whether you think of a virtual environment as an artifact or not, as a self-consciously designed artifact. And if you start worrying about what purposes we might design such an artifact for, the question of whether we might also, in a sense, be in a simulated environment, irrespective of what we want to be in or what we've designed for ourselves, it's a fascinating epistemic question, and it's been around in some sense as long as Descartes. But I think the question of how we should value artifactual virtual environments is a somewhat different one, and it's the one I'm more interested in, to be honest. Just because I'm a bit of a skeptic about sorting out the epistemic questions without reference to why would we want this.
Mm-hmm. And those epistemic questions that you are referring to, what sort of questions are they exactly? Could you give us some examples?
Well, are we a brain in a vat? Is the classic and the most abstract way of putting it, right? Is there any way we could prove that we weren't a brain in a vat, which is the old Hillary Putnam argument? Or the slightly newer, more fun one, Nick Bostrom's question about what the probability is that we're all living in a computer simulation. Fascinating argument by Nick Bostrom, who thinks that because of certain facts about how the computers work compared to the brain, and certain facts about what we think our attitude is toward technological progress, the null hypothesis is that there's a 33% chance that we're in a computer simulation. He really makes that argument. It's a very, very strange result to come to. And of course, says, that's an argument based on axioms of probability theory, not based on any evidence we could get by observing, because of course, if it's a simulation, it's a very good one. So those epistemic questions are fascinating, but operate largely independently of the question of, whether we need more or less simulation in our lives, or what types of simulation we could engineer, as we're doing already, with computer games and other kinds of games and theatrical acting, and certain sorts of pharmaceuticals, in a way that's there's perhaps a more pressing need to subject to philosophical scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Going back to one thing that I said before when I was referring to Donald Hoffman and the case against reality, do you think it, or at least would it be in any way problematic to you if people were to create a machine that stimulated people's brains, for example, in a way that would produce experiences or representations of things in their minds that would be undistinguishable from reality? Do you think that would be... that would pose in any way any important ethical questions in terms of the development of that type of technology or not?
On the contrary, actually, I think there are pressing reasons to suppose that this would be an unmixed good, at least for certain people. One of the things that's been pointed out about the experience machine thought experiment, actually by one of the contributors to my anthology about this, Daniel Petruca, is there are clearly some people in the world whose condition is such that an experience machine would be an unequivocal improvement in their lives. And the more so to the extent that they couldn't tell that it wasn't real. Petruca points out, and this is a very typical debate for political philosophers, Nozick's readership is an educated, leisured bourgeoisie, mostly people who aren't sick, right? And it's only perhaps in that sort of circumstance that you can make a fuss about wanting your experiences to be of reality, even if that's an epistemically privileged position. It's certainly not one that everyone's in. So Petruca comes pretty close to suggesting there's actually a political mandate to make these things. Now, of course, if you're a conventionally liberal views, the problem arises not so much if people can't distinguish the output of the experience machine from reality. But if there's something other than consent involved, if, for example, you put children into it, or if people make the transition without knowing, I think any fairly sturdy liberal or libertarian would have, would think there was an absolute prohibition against that. There would at least have to be consent, even in these circumstances where the person was suffering. I'm more of a socialist and I'm more willing to cut corners, but I'm not exactly sure where. So that, I think, is a deeply interesting and ethically salient debate that divides along interesting ideological lines in the philosophy of politics.
Do you think that perhaps one of the things that worries people most in the experience machine thought experiment, let's say, is the fact that it is sort of irreversible, in the sense that if people choose to go into there, then they can't come back? Maybe that's one of the things that people would fear the most, I guess.
Yes, I think that's in some ways one of the most fascinating ambiguities of the thought experiment. I think it's absolutely clear that if it were reversible, you'd be pretty crazy not to try it on. I mean, and given, you know, the popularity of video games and increasingly immersive video games, you know, for example, anything you play on an Oculus or a Vive, where the head tracking deliberately tricks you about the environment, or it deliberately outpaces your senses. Given the willingness of people to try that out for at least a little while, and the apparent moral harmlessness of doing so, it's obviously the fact that you're stuck in the experience machine that generates the aversion, right? What's ambiguous about that, and it's an ambiguity that Nozick, and really, I don't want to brag, but pretty much anybody before my anthology never properly confronted, is that to the extent that's aversive, to the extent that we think, oh, it'd be horrible to be in there for the rest of our lives, is that because it's just too much simulated experience? Is there a bar over which one passes, at which point one's more like an addict, I suppose, than like a voluntary participant? Or is it a matter of there being, you know, quantitative increases are good up to a sufficiency and then it becomes bad? Or is it a matter of there being something wrong with simulation itself? Something wrong with having, you know, any one simulated experience such that you always need an escape condition, okay? So it's not a question of the experience between putting too much simulated experience in your life. It's just the fact that you can't escape itself, which makes it bad, because simulated experience in any quantity has some badness to it. I think that's a very deep ambiguity that is difficult to tease out, because either of these attitudes would generate the same aversion, I think.
And earlier you were referring to certain types of people that perhaps, if we could develop this sort of machine, we would in a way be morally obliged to do it, to help these people, like, for example, chronically depressed people and people with all sorts of mental conditions where they are basically continually suffering, right? And people who have suicidal thoughts and things like that. I mean, awful human mental experiences. And it's interesting because it seems to me that some of the people that don't like this idea or even feel disgusted by it, of course I'm here referring to, for example, religious people that might have some purity arguments, you know, against simulations, because this is reality as it is, God created it, and so on and so forth, and people have to live like this. The thing is that even with other technologies that we've already developed, like analgesics and things like that, I mean, we're not forcing people to use them. It's a choice that they have. And I mean, if someone still wants to experiencing a certain degree of suffering, for example, in their lives, because they can derive some meaning from it, I mean, they wouldn't be forced to go into the simulated reality, right?
Well, I think that certainly makes the development of these sorts of technologies less controversial. But of course, past a certain stage of mental debilitation, or in the case of someone who's, say, in hospice care, issues of consent can become a little difficult, right?
Sure.
And then, you know, there's a fascinating paper in my anthology by Alexis Elder, who's a very smart philosopher in Minnesota, who's written a bunch of essays about interactions with robots. about how robot friends are used in elder care, which is apparently more of a thing, I think, in Northern Europe than in the U.S. But people in old folks' homes have robot companions who interact with them verbally. These aren't things that could pass the Turing test. But of course, you don't just foist one on some poor old soul, you know, in their late 90s who doesn't want to have a robot in their room. But there's a certain amount of, if not deceit, then at least harmless manipulation in saying to someone, here's your robot friend, they're just like a real person, when there's no way they could understand the algorithms that generate their responses, right? So they really don't know what it is that makes this thing an artifact, what it is that makes this thing different from a person. And one could find that more ethically troubling if one was worried about issues of consent. So those are interesting marginal cases that fall short of something like a full-on experience machine that's shoved on your head and that you can never leave.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we can also connect this discussion with issues surrounding AI more generally, in the sense that, for example, there are certain people that are worried about the possibility of us reaching a point where we no longer understand what our AI systems are doing, even though they might be doing things better than us, and then we give them more and more power over our lives, and then there might be an AI takeover or something like that. And I was just wondering if, in this case, since we're talking about putting people into some sort of machine that would create or feed their brains directly with a simulated reality. I mean, maybe we could think about it if the reality was to be good enough for that person, or at least better than our reality. It could be an AI system that would be fed by some sort of information, like, for example, when we go to Amazon or Netflix and buy stuff there or watch some stuff, and then the algorithm gives us some recommendations of what to buy next or what to watch next, and then we get into a situation where the algorithm seems to know more about ourselves than we consciously know, let's say. So, I mean, do you think that that argument is also relevant here, that maybe to a certain extent, if people were to put themselves into that sort of technology and experience simulated reality, that there could be at least a risk of that piece of technology, the AI system that we would be simulating it, taking over people's lives in some sort of important way?
So a couple of different components to that question. On the question of whether, we call the question of strong AI in the philosophy of computing, question of how close we are to engineering something that is, in all the salient respects, undifferentiable from a human mind, or, you know, the question of the singularity, as it's often called in science fiction, where we can make an AI that's too smart for us to understand. I'm something of a skeptic. I've been thinking about this a lot. I've just been writing a long paper about David Chalmers' views about the singularity and how they compare to science fiction. Not because I don't think a singularity is possible, but that I think we're so far from understanding how the transition from present limits on computers work to what would constitute a singularity, that pretty much everything we have to say about it now is going to be pretty banal, really just theology in disguise. Same thing with strong AI, right? I mean, you have this, all these claims that these advocates of the singularity make about increasing speed and processing, attempts to capture the bandwidth of the spinal column, and then one day we'll get intelligence, which is this sort of argumentative fairy dust sprinkled over the argument to make it sound more exciting. I don't think it's very exciting. I think whatever AI or strong AI or the singularity turns out to be, if we get there before global warming ruins everything, of course, right? I think it's going to surprise us more than these arguments anticipate. That having been said, the suggestion you made that an experience machine could be more like a sort of an Amazon software agent that might not be a super mind, but might be smart enough to anticipate our preferences better than we can. That's a fascinating possibility. And it wouldn't take strong AI to do that, right? I mean, human preference, experiential preferences might not be the most sophisticated thing about us, right? It's mostly, you know, sex and food and you know, habit, I suppose. It's a worry, it's a concern, and it's why Nozick has this stipulation that you can step out of the experience machine to change your menu, which he thinks you absolutely need to make it even somewhat attractive to the hedonist, right? This idea that you have the authority to change your pleasures. If an experienced machine could do that as a software agent, setting aside the question of whether it would also be a super mind that took us over like a malevolent, you know, like a Cartesian demon, it's hard to answer the question of how ethical or unethical or ethically problematic that would be until you knew who plugged us in and why, right? If it was a supermind, how much would that supermind, you know, resemble, say, you know, the government of Sweden versus the government of, say, Eritrea? I think those are the right questions to ask. As to whether the decision was made by a human or a machine, I think, you know, we have so little idea of what a human-like AI would look like that it's really just a decorative feature of the question.
Okay, so we were talking about the experience machine and giving too much power to AI. I mean, I was just wondering, because sometimes I think a little bit about this. People are worried about that sort of black box argument that, okay, so if we create AI systems that for us function as a black box because we can't understand the operations that are going around there. I mean, we know the result that they produce, but we can't understand how they arrive at it. I was just wondering to what extent that is really problematic, because it seems to me that not only that also happens with our own minds, in the sense that we don't seem to have direct access to most of what happens in our minds, because most happens at an unconscious level, but also even in our everyday lives, it is the case that we delegate many decisions to other people that are more knowledgeable than we are in several different areas, like, for example, doctors. And I mean, we also don't know medicine to know if they are really making good decisions or not. So, I mean, in a sense, I guess that what I'm trying to say is that people seem more worried about AI than they are about other things in their lives that they deal with somewhat in similar ways.
I think that's exactly right. I absolutely agree with you that this delegation is part of living in a modern industrialized world with division of intellectual labor. And it sometimes it has bad results and sometimes it has good results. I would agree with you that raising the specter of there being some special problem when you delegate to a machine, I think that's not much more than superstition, partly because it's so hard to imagine what a machine would look like before we were even prepared to delegate to it, right? I think that, you know, futurists who think they have a grasp on that are mostly just blowing smoke. I would go even a little bit further and say, here's something that you get from delegating your decisions to a machine that you don't get from delegating your decisions to human beings. There's one thing we know about human beings, and that is we are overwhelmingly strongly disposed to compete violently over scarce resources. Machines just need to plug into the wall, right? Now, you know, maybe if you had an AI that was at human level, it would suddenly decide it wanted all the cod or all the coffee or all the palm oil in the world. Seems pretty unlikely, though. And this is why, you know, most of the best science fiction that explores these issues of the ethics of interacting with AI and delegating your decisions to AI tends to happen in a political environment where scarcity's mostly been overcome. I think the novels of Ian M. Banks, for example, there are a lot of deeply morally ambiguous interactions between human beings and machines in those novels. But in the meantime, scarcity's gone. Human lifespans are as long as you want, and everybody gets 3 square meals a day. And for all that the moral, different moral ambiguities might resurface, you at least don't people have people hoarding commodities, right? So that's a reason to be cautiously optimistic about delegation to machines relative to the kind of delegation we currently do in first world societies anyway.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that I thought about when I was preparing the interview, because we are talking about simulated realities, is that I think that nowadays we already have access to and frequently use technologies that pose some of the problems that people are worried about, like, for example, social media, Facebook, and things like that. Because, I mean, it is the case nowadays that people form a lot of relationships, friendships, and so on with people that maybe, at least some of them, they will never directly interact with in their lives. I mean, they won't ever be personally, let's say, with them, or at least in a direct way, let's say. So, I mean, if we were to think about an experience machine that would simulate other people, just for us to have the sensation, let's say, that we were interacting with others, I mean, would it in some way be that different from what people already do in a less sophisticated way?
Yeah. Again, since we're so far from having an AI that will pass the Turing test, I think the idea that, I think the suggestion that there's some special problem with a ubiquitous AI that could interact with us through social media is really just a slightly dressed up way of facing the anxieties we have with social media now, right? Now, in the case of people with robot companions, or people who lock themselves away with Alexa and lose their friendships because they're really comfortable talking to what we have now, which is a black box that just does your shopping for you, that's interesting. It's interesting that something that can't pass the Turing test could figure like a friend in people's lives as it is now. I confess I find that a bit disturbing. I find that a little unsettling that a robot companion could really replace a person who could conduct the kind of conversation that Turing envisaged. But there's a really, really deep and fascinating and very aggressively conducted debate going on right now in philosophy about whether social media friendships are real friendships. I've been enormously impressed with the sophistication and the depth that this has gone into. I think it, you know, rivals Aristotle. It's all being carried out in this one journal called Ethical Theories and Moral Problems, I think. I'm blanking on its name. But at any rate, a lot of people, especially existentialists who always talk this way, think that, well, you can't have an authentic friendship through an artificial medium like social media. I don't want to dismiss those intuitions, but I think there's at least another side to the story, and it's a side that not only says that a simulated friendship is as good as a real one, but that social media provides some advantages to friendship that aren't present in ordinary face-to-face friendship, two of which are, first of all, absence of spontaneity. Now, spontaneity is, human spontaneity can be a charming thing, but I'm not sure that the net effect of removing complete spontaneity from human relationships is to make them less intimate or less authentic or less real. Most of us, when it comes to dealing with people we care about, think very hard and prepare our responses to them very hard. And social media gives you, makes that an imperative. You know, you have to hit enter before the person will see anything. That can be an advantage, and maybe it's an advantage that's enough to outweigh, you know, the fact that you don't have a completely off-the-cuff response to people, at least for some of us, especially those of us who enjoy writing or who regard it as, you know, a vital form of self-expression, more so than, say, just showing my emotions on our face. Second claim, and this is a much more political claim, an argument that's made by Matthew Tedesco, social media friendships don't generate partiality in the same way. Because you tend to have more of them, they tend to be more dispensable, more ephemeral. Even if you have very high quality communication with a social media friend, you don't tend to necessarily think that they're interested to be preferred over those of a stranger, at least their economic or political interests. And Tedesco's point is just, in a fundamentally unjust society such as ours, you shouldn't allow yourself the luxury of too much partiality. You should be trying to advance political causes and economic causes that benefit strangers as much as your intimates. The more your friendships are based on a medium that divorces you from partiality, the more likely you are to have an appetite for justice. That's a rather chilling view of the benefit of friendship. And Tedesco's view is it's not that the other more partial kind of friendship isn't better in some ways; it's that we don't deserve it. I think that's an intuition that's worth taking at least a little bit seriously.
Right. Well, I think those are two very interesting arguments. And picking up on the issue of authenticity, I mean, that's a bit tricky, right? Because even in everyday face-to-face friendships, let's say, and other types of direct relationships, people also can question to what extent people are authentic, right? Because, isn't it the case that frequently people try to deceive one another or take advantage in some way, even when they are friends? I mean, because, to be honest, people are not friends with one another, I mean, unconditionally, right? I mean, people always want to at least gain something out of giving some of their time to another person. So, I mean, even the instrumental side of things, I guess that if people try to put it completely aside, it is a too idealistic way of looking at human relationships.
I think that's probably true. I'm a little bit of a skeptic about the idea of an entirely non-instrumental friendship. But from my point of view, here's the other thing. Even the very best kind of friendships we can value, in my opinion, they involve a lot of willing or half-willing performance, a lot of deliberate inauthenticity for the sake of amusement or entertainment or play. Most of my best friends I play games with where we pretend to be, you know, what depending on the friends, you know, characters in a role-playing game, where we just imitate, you know, the accents we've heard. And that's an indication that the best friendships treat authenticity as negotiable. Not because you would be comfortable with your best friend deceiving you and manipulating for their private gain necessarily. But because authenticity by itself, endless authenticity with another person is tedious, desperately boring, and epistemically stifling. It's better to use a friendship to experiment on and trying to learn about the rest of the world, I think, which can involve an element of performance and even only partly consensual manipulation. To trust and to love a friend is to say to them, fake it for me a little bit, right? I trust you. But it's okay if you're occasionally inauthentic or occasionally artificial without warning me first. So I think, again, I don't think authenticity is a value to be sneered at. But I'm very uncomfortable and frankly mystified with ethical theories that treat authenticity and autonomy, Kantian autonomy, which is this slightly older notion, as being above price, above negotiation. That seems to me to be a distortion of human nature, both in the optimistic side and in the pessimistic side.
And maybe perhaps also things related to honesty, right? Because, I mean, do we really want people to be absolutely honest about what they think about us and what they think about themselves and, I mean, those sorts of things?
Yeah. Sometimes, yes. Sometimes we're indifferent. And sometimes we give up honesty as a luxury rather than as a necessity for the sake of tact and so forth. So, yeah, I agree with you about that.
Okay, so let's now get into issues surrounding games and the philosophy of video games. But before getting specifically into video games, let's talk a little bit about world building that can also be applied to not only to video games, but also to virtual reality or simulated realities that we might create. So, I mean, what do you think are some of the most important questions that we have to ask when we are thinking about creating a world that people will interact with and maybe even will include some entities there that we could at least think might have some personhood, let's say?
So the literature about virtual reality, which is very new in philosophy, it only goes really back to this book from, I think, the 1990s by a guy named Michael Heim. The way that the virtual worlds and environments are usually talked about, what makes them the way they are, what distinguishes them from, mere images or mirages or ordinary perceptual illusions, is this rather elusive factor that Heim refers to as immersivity, right? The fact that you're not just deceived, but you're immersed in a back and forth interactive experience with something in the environment. And that always involves, to some extent, an element of self-deceit, or at least willing suspension of some epistemically reliable attitude. So obviously, it's of the very nature of virtual worlds to manipulate us, to trick us, at least insofar as they outpace our sensoria, which they do in a way that you can't help but experience just with something like an Oculus or a Vive, even if you know with complete certainty you're in a VR and you can leave it at any time. So it's the ethics of manipulation, the ethics of willing self-deceit that I think is so useful and interesting to explore with this image of a virtual world. For me, what's interesting about the parity of sort of human interaction in a virtual world with something that's not a strong AI or a person, but something that you interact with like an agent, is the extent to which this can be a venue for moral experimentation, right? When you play an avatar that's constrained in its activity in totally different ways than you are in your real life, when you observe and interact with artificial beings, and you know that they're not people and can't be regarded as having anything like rights, but you can observe and experiment upon their reactions in something like the way you could observe and experiment on a real person. The ethical issue is, do you, obviously you learn from doing this. Obviously you get a richer, potentially more nuanced view of human activity and human voluntariness. Do you pay anything for that? Is there any kind of moral sacrifice you have to make to engage in that kind of experimentation? This is an analog to the question that sometimes comes up in literary aesthetics, which is, sure, reading fiction can teach you about human nature in the real world, and it's enormously enriching to your worldview. But at a certain point, obsessing about people who don't really exist, seems like it's a source of moral risk. It's just very difficult to figure out how. The moral risk, I think, is different for VR, since it's VR is immersive in a way that fiction isn't necessarily, and tricks you in a way that it's fair to say fiction really can't. But I think that they're parallel questions. So I think it's a question less in the ethics of how you behave in the virtual world than in the sort of moral aesthetics of what significance it plays in the rest of your life.
And this moral risk you're talking about, is it different when the characters that are part of the video game are just, are just characters, no one is controlling them, than when, for example, people play online games and the characters there are controlled by other people?
I think it's very different. And in competitive or collaborative multiplayer gaming, a whole bunch of new issues arise that honestly, I think the human mind is very ill prepared to deal with, right? We know this already from seeing the horrible toxic culture that comes out of comments threads and social media, which most people don't even think of as a game, although I think in a only slightly extended sense of the word, it is really. But interacting with people's avatars in a multiplayer game, playing competitively against someone in a game like StarCraft, the way that they do with manic intensity in South Korea, right? Does raise extra ethical issues. And again, it goes both ways. There are terrible, terrible things that you can do to a person's avatar that, with consent or within the rules of a well-designed game, are clearly not morally culpable and may even be morally therapeutic. But there's also the risk of, there's the same risk you get when you harm, someone you don't know, right? I mean, you can't tell how a person is reacting to the behavior of their avatar in a real in a virtual world by how the avatar behaves. And there's at least some moral imperative to try and guess at that in a way that we're terribly ill-equipped to do. Not just gamers, but anyone who wants to try this medium. I think that's a large reason why a lot of intelligence-sensitive people are very shy of the medium of multiplayer gaming. The fact that you can't tell what's happening to a person by what's happening to their avatar makes them appropriately nervous.
Mm-hmm. So this raises questions about to what extent people might project or expand their personal identities to their avatars, right?
Certainly true. Yeah, that's something we spent a chapter on in the book that I wrote with John Cogburn back about, I guess, over a decade now. It's obviously, in one sense, trivia to say that your avatar isn't you, but in another sense, there's something like identification going on. There's something more intimate than just watching a character on a screen and hoping that they do well. Very tricky to figure out what that relationship is. And it becomes more tricky if you're kind of a skeptic or a nihilist about the very concept of personal identity that's been discussed in philosophy since Descartes, as I tend to be. If you have sort of a sidelong skeptical view of the whole idiom of talking about the continuity of the self through time, well, it might not ultimately refer to anything metaphysically real, but it's pretty indispensable to our ethical discourse, right? So how, if you're, you know, a skeptic about the mind or the soul or the continuing identity, how do you marshal that vocabulary? How do you discipline that vocabulary so that we can talk about it in a responsible way? It's a very deep question. Of course, if you're a realist about the self, or you think that, you know, morality is in some important way tied to self-development or living a whole life the way Aristotle talks about, makes things simpler in some ways, but of course it makes the stakes much higher.
So in this case, it's not really that important that that sense of continuity of the self is real itself, but simply that it is still important for people or has some sort of impact in their lives and how they structure, for example, their personal narratives. I mean, it has, it seems to me, a real impact on people's lives still.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, even if you don't think that there's some standard of realism to which such narratives should aspire, or that there's some real phenomenon of the continuity of the self which we can succeed or fail at tracking, I don't really believe either of those things. It's still enormously ethically important how people in fact do it, and how you might interfere with that or how you might aid it through the use of this new unfamiliar medium, right? Where people are saying things like, I want to go and kill 20 orcs. I want to collect cheese, when they're really talking about a bunch of pixels inside of World of Warcraft or Skyrim, right? Right. One certainly has to pay attention to how that's used and what it means for the people who do it in a way that the screen, you know, impedes access to. You've got to have a theory of it when you play, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think that through video games, people can also explore other aspects of their personal identity, even what we could call maybe how their personal identity is in some sort of way plural, right? For example, by exploring archetypes, there are games where people have to choose one type of character, for example. I mean, there is a limited number of characters, and as we were talking about before, people care about authenticity, but it seems that at least in video games, they can explore aspects of themselves that they in some way would aspire to, in a sense, I guess.
Sure, yeah, and that's wonderful. It's a wonderfully magical thing about any medium that uses avatars, and it's why video games deserve to be taken seriously as fine art. I mean, above all else, it's for this ethical reason. You know, the problem with using a word like explore, although I can't think of a better one, is that it does make the process sound a little detached. When you explore a new, you can't explore a new identity without identifying with it, right? If you're not morally implicated in the fate of this being, however transitory it might be, you're not exploring an identity at all. You're just moving counters around a board, right? So It's an experiment, but it's an experiment, the normal ethics of experimentation and the normal epistemology of experimentation that you find in accounts of the scientific method don't really do justice to. Right? Exploring an identity means identifying it with something and seeing how it feels. And at a certain point, if you're doing it properly, unplugging should become more difficult. Saying, okay, I'm not that being anymore, should become harder in a way. And of course, you know, one can become obsessive, and addiction to the internet, addiction to games, is one of these things that psychologists talk about, and it's hovering on the outer edges of the DSM right now in psychology, and is very debatable. But in a certain sense, if you don't feel a compulsion to advance the interests of your avatar, you're not really at the point of experimenting yet, right? So it gives you this new ephemeral medium for experimentation, but it's always one that's somewhat morally implicating. When you look at the early very sort of cheesy old fighting games like Virtua Fighter and Tekken and Mortal Kombat, it's astonishing the extent to which American males would favor female characters over male characters, including many males who exhibit no signs of gender dysphoria, in fact, who are, you know, somewhat toxically masculine. No one's ever really told a convincing story about why that is, except just to say, well, I guess it's an experiment. But what kind of experiment? What does it show about their sense of their own identity? I think philosophy and psychology are still catching up to the possibilities afforded by the medium in this way.
Mm-hmm. And I think another interesting aspect to talk about here has to do with role-playing, because as you were referring to, it's a bit tricky to talk about people identifying with other things, like if they have detached identities or different sorts of identities. But for example, I was just wondering if there are games or aspects in games where people are allowed to explore certain aspects of their personality, for example, that they wouldn't be able to do in real life, and I mean also to what extent that would extrapolate to other aspects of their lives, and if they could even enrich other aspects of their lives in some ways. I mean, what do you think about that?
Sure. Yeah, this is in a sense the one issue about video games that everybody's worried about, because of course the paradigmatic example of this kind of experimentation is with violence, and one should be deeply concerned that experimenting with violence through an avatar changes one's attitude toward violence outside of a virtual realm in ways that are hard to predict and potentially socially dangerous. Very little indication that actually happens, and certainly the way politicians talk about it doesn't help to clarify it, especially over here in the US, where they will say literally anything to let people buy hundreds of guns next door, right? So that debate's pretty much irrevocably polluted in the US as long as we still fuss about the Second Amendment. Again, you know, the interesting thing about violence is that it goes both ways. T. Nguyen has this fascinating take on video game violence, according to which if the game is designed properly, then the very fact that you can indulge in the most horrific sort of violence through your avatar is a moral plus for the game, because you're able to both experiment with the visual and the affective aspects of engaging in violence, while at the same time self-consciously realizing, this is the rule of a game these are the rules of a game that make it okay that I'm about to leave, right? And that's exactly the opposite toward most to most of the violence that occurs in reality, where it's a simple matter of a loss of control, the removal of ordinary psychological impediments, right? A game by its very nature is a set of psychological impediments, and experimenting with violence through a medium that you voluntarily accepted has those characteristics. I don't know what necessarily want to say. It can be predicted to have a positive moral effect to purge you necessarily. That's a bold prediction, and it's the business of psychologists. But it at least fundamentally changes the character of the violence in the game. So that's the kind of experimentation that sort of drives the bus when philosophers talk about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we can also establish an analogy with things that people do even in their real lives. Like, for example, there are people that have some sexual fetishes, like, for example, BDSM and things like that, and they create niche activities or niche groups where they go to with people that also like those kinds of things, and they meet together. And the interesting thing there is that they are somewhat marginal, because I mean, they are part of society, but at the same time they are not, in the sense that I mean, it's not the case that any kind of person goes there, or they are even allowed to. So I mean, there's also these aspects, right? It's not just video games by themselves, but I mean, what people are allowed to do in video games, they, if they don't have access to them, or if they are not interested in doing it through video games, they always try to find out a place or a niche where they can explore things that are non-normative, let's say.
Sure. And you know, a bit of a plug for video games as a medium at this point, doing that, organizing a subculture of sexual fetishists, or something like, say, a fight club, to come back to the example of violence, in a liberal society, we think that it's appropriate to allow people to do that kind of thing. We should have fairly high standards of consent in the first place. But in the second place, even once you have high standards of consent that you're able to monitor and enforce, it's enormously resource intensive and enormously expensive and difficult. It requires huge amounts of leisure. And then it's subject to horrific risk, right? Because part of what makes fetishistic sexual behavior and consensual violence attractive to folks is the fact that it comes with a sense of real risk, right? So video games provide a simulacrum of that, that minimizes the risk and obliterates the cost. All you need is an internet connection these days, right? The question is, do those very facts remove the point of the exercise? The optimistic view is they don't have to. Okay, if you simulate the marginalism, if you simulate the community, you can also simulate the sense of risk that makes it attractive to people in the first place. That to me is enormously appealing, partly for political reasons, right? I mean, fetishism and consensual violence are the purview of the upper middle classes in our societies, and they shouldn't be. And the computer is in the long run, perhaps, and the internet is perhaps a genuine political solution to that problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. But when you were referring to risk that people might expose themselves to, were you referring only to the fact that sometimes people might expose themselves to, for example, violence, to harm, even sometimes to direct physical harm that they might even like, of course, but or were you also including there the fact that they might be risking themselves in the sense that if other people find out about that, they might be stigmatized or ostracized or something like that?
Sure, yeah, both. There's both the risk of social stigma and the risk of permanent physical harm. And of course, the social stigma, given how little we know about how much we're being watched on computers, that's a problem computers don't seem especially well built to solve. The one thing about sealing off your basement is there's probably nobody snuck in a camera, right? But the additional risk, and the one that I think often is somewhat paradoxically a great part of the appeal of fetishism and of consensual violence, is the risk about the manipulation of your own pleasure systems, the risk at some point in some carefully planned sexual experience, something that you thought you would like, you turn out not to like. Building a community around people who find the prospect of that kind of risk within their own psychology titillating, again, very difficult, very expensive, and an enormous amount of knowledge of other people's psychology is necessary. And again, as long as it's so mysterious to us, why we're willing to do that, how far we're willing to take it, and at what point this will become a concern for another person, a more ephemeral medium like a video game can at least reduce the real risk without reducing the sense of risk necessarily. Which again, I take to be a good thing, although, you know, it might seem less authentic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in terms of video games, just before we end the interview, are there any other aspects that you would like to tell people about? For example, since you are a video game player, what would you tell someone that is somewhat skeptical about the benefits of playing video games, perhaps because he or she is an old person that didn't really play with these sorts of things in their childhood or in adolescence or something like that, and they look at video games and they think that people who play them, I mean, are just wasting their lives or something like that?
So here the advice to give is really just the advice that anybody who's been fortunate enough as I have to become intimately tied up with a particular medium. I think it's a mistake to try and give a general theory about what makes the whole medium worthwhile. The best advice to give someone like that is to direct them toward particular examples, right? And to say, go and play Myst, which is what, for me, one of the great masterpieces of Western art for the late 20th century. Go and play a very old text-based computer game, which are interactive in the same way, immersive in the same way, but also art objects in a more familiar sense. You know, something like the old Infocom games, which from the 70s, which were commercial, but in retrospect, masterpieces of design. And learn the lesson. You know, I'm a Humean about art. I think you learn the lesson from generalizing from particular experiences. You don't start out with the theory of what makes aesthetic value and then go and try and find it. That dooms you from the start. And then, of course, the other thing I'd say is you have to cultivate an attitude that explicitly goes against the grain of commercialism, right? I think anybody growing up, any sensitive person growing up right now, who sees the veneration that educated people have for superhero movies, the natural response ought to be complete repugnance for film as a medium. And I think the only solution to that is you've got to be a little bohemian. You've got to be a little bit esoteric in your preferences. You've got to look for this stuff that a cultivated but commercially suppressed elite are looking for. And that's the same with computer games. And it's harder because computer games are a more incunabular meeting. Medium, the indie community of small-scale developers who produce art games for something other than just getting rich is less well-organized, less uniformly competent, to be honest, and you've got to look between the cracks. But certainly once you've done a little bit of that, anything that intimidates you about just the medium itself of a computer or an Oculus Rift or a cell phone, that will evaporate if you're seriously interested in finding examples of beauty in human artifice. So, you know, ultimately, I just say, try that one, come back and tell me what you found. I think that's the best argument that can ever be made within the arts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So, Dr. Silcox, just before we go, what are the best places on the internet if people want to get in touch with your work?
Pretty much all my work is on PhilPapers, which is a big database of information about professional and academic philosophers. My two most recent books are still in print for however long by Rutledge and Roman and Littlefield. Apart from that, I keep a fairly low profile on the internet outside of Facebook, which I use as a teacher mostly. But always happy to talk to people. Please don't be shy about contacting me. I think you can probably provide contact information via the podcast. I'm writing about this stuff right now, and my book on simulated experience is just starting to be reviewed. So it's hot off the presses, or warm off the presses. Following the discussion that I hope emerges from that, we'll bring you closest to the sorts of topics we've talked about today if you're interested.
Do you already have a title for that book and know where it will be out, when it
Oh
will
yeah.
be out?
Oh, it actually came out January in Britain and the US. I'm not sure if there's a separate European release date, but it's called A Defensive Simulated Experience. It's my first monograph, quite a short book. And really, we've been going over the themes that I discuss in that book through your very well-chosen questions today. So that's what I would recommend. It's expensive, unfortunately, so maybe get it out of an academic library. But quite a short, easy read, and it's where I address these issues with as much explicitness as I've ever managed.
Okay, so Dr. Silcox, again, it was really a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for taking the time, and maybe if you like, in the future, we could do another conversation because I mean, I've been exploring these topics, particularly about emergent technology and the philosophy behind it, with several people recently, so I'm very interested in that.
Certainly, I'd be happy to. This was a lot of fun.
Hi everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Any amount, even just $1, would already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and subscribe to the channel. You can also support me on PayPal or Subscribestar. All of the links are in the description box of the interview. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perelga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantal Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Brian Rivera, Lucas Stafiniak, Sergio Condreano, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, John Connors, Adam Castle, Vega Giddy, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Dias, Dr. Jerry Muller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, and Bo Weingart, and also my three producers, Izar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.